This is Kate Scott Allen of Otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
This episode of Herding Code is brought to you by RunScope Radar. RunScope Radar is a tool for automated testing and monitoring of your app's API integrations. It allows you to verify your app's APIs are up and returning correct data as often as every minute. It offers flexible assertions, change requests, and integration with a lot of popular services like PagerDuty, New Relic Insights, Keen.io, HipChat, and more. And the cool news is that it's now available from 8 locations around the world. RunScope. Everything is going to be 418 Teapot.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code being recorded on July 10th, 2014. Today's guest is Michael Mahamal. And Mike, could you give us a quick introduction?
Sure. So, yeah, I'm Mike Mahamal. I'm based in London, originally Australian, but I've been in London over a decade now. Kind of a mixed background. My studies were on, I actually managed to do a major in psychology and software engineering at a time when it might have seemed a bit of an odd combo, but now I think it's sort of very much in vogue with user experience and so on. Did a PhD that really combined the two on design patterns and user experience. And since then, I've done sort of a mix of those two disciplines of just, you know, really a lot of hands-on code, full stack, and a lot on HTML5, got really into Ajax at the time. And what I'm working on now is Player FM, which is a cloud-based podcast app, which is very much focused on discovery. So really helping people to find great content by following curated topics about very specific niches. And also this kind of multi-device world that we're living in, it's very much focused on making sure everything's synced in the cloud.
Yeah, Player FM seems like a pretty popular application. And I was curious what sort of technology you used to build that.
Yeah, depends how detailed you want to go, but basically I can give you a sort of a 10,000 foot high architecture overview. It's a podcast app, so it's trying to do what I'm sure your listeners are very familiar with podcast apps. A lot of them have this sort of traditional model of being a standalone app just running on the user's phone. And so every hour it will sort of poll the feeds that the user has subscribed to and check if the feed has changed. And if so, it'll update and, delete the old ones maybe and add the new ones. What I'm trying to do is transplant that into the cloud. So it's trying to bring as much intelligence to the servers as possible so that we can sort of scale out and build different clients for different platforms without having to reinvent the wheel every time. So the architecture is, I think the guts of it is the whole business of feed fetching, which happens on the server rather than in the individual phones. And that has several advantages. It means that it saves the user's phone's bandwidth and battery, and it can fetch a lot faster because it's already aware for all the feeds that are out there which ones have updated recently. I have a couple of mechanisms to do the fetching. We can get into that. And then the other big aspect, of course, is the actual application. So there's a website, which is actually how Player FM started as a HTML5 web app. I call it really, it's kind of like a hybrid or what some people call a PJAX architecture. So it's not like a fancy new single page app. It's actually pushing the HTML5 content from the server, the actual markup. And there's reasons for that to do with, being able to be accessible, run without JavaScript and performance benefits. But it is actually quite interactive as a JavaScript app as well. So it will let you do playing and it'll let you change pages dynamically while the episode keeps playing, but using HTML5 history API to make sure that the URLs are being updated. So that's the web server piece. And then really the third big component is related to that. It's the API. So it's a very RESTful API. It's got some interesting features we could get into later on as well, if you like, to do with performance optimization and I guess kind of what I like to call developer experience, you know, the sort of ergonomics of the API.
Yeah, that would be interesting to get into. Maybe we could do that first and then talk about some of your client applications, maybe how you build those. But so the server is mostly API REST-based and it's built with...
It's built with Rails, so I work on Rails. Yeah, so I didn't get in much of the actual technology just there. It was really just the architecture. But, it's the server is Rails. as I mentioned, it's sort of like the website is running in the sort of traditional model of pushing out the HTML. The server is closely tied to that, so very much using the same data structures and even a lot of the time the same controllers, but just, you know, sending out different formats. So you've got the pattern, I think, which is that nice RESTful pattern of being able to take any URL. So if you take, player.fm/featured/tech, which is our featured technology topic, you can just append to that .json or .rss and get back the same content that's in obviously computer readable formats. What's interesting about the API, a couple of things that I had to really think about, you know, sort of take a step back from how people are doing APIs and try to build something that's pretty easily usable. And I should say it's not a public API. It's, you know, just something that we're using internally. It's certainly available for people if they want to experiment with it, but it's not like an officially supported external API yet. And the way it works for our own apps, the phone app in particular, the Android app and the website, is they make these kind of RESTful calls for resources. But I think one of the challenges people have with APIs is to do with granularity and not trying to get some massive tree of everything that might be underneath a resource hierarchically. So the way I dealt with that challenge was to actually set up a spectrum of detail levels. And so rather than sort of saying you can get every field and you can say, I want this field and this field, but not that field. The problem with doing that is it's not very scalable. It means you can't cache any resources, you know, because you're going to have all these different clients wanting different things. So I decided to come up with a spectrum of having four levels that you could actually request of any particular resource, which could range from none to ID, to just getting basically the raw ID, to I think I call it medium, which is just, you know, sort of ID, title, and some vital information that would be enough to get something interactive and something working. And then you get the full Monty if you ask for a detail of full. So for any resource that you can request, typically the high level, the root level of that resource, it doesn't matter. You can get all the fields because it's not really going to be a performance hit. But if you're then going to get a list of children for that resource, you know, it's going to be a big resource constraint if you're going to have to start requesting lots of children and grandchildren and all the fields. So for that, that's where you can start to say, you know, I want the user, and that will give you all the fields of the user, but I only want, you know, for the user's channels that they're subscribed to, I only want medium level detail. You know, I just want their title, the channel title and URL, and maybe the last time it was updated. That will make sure that it doesn't start sending you the grandchildren of this object that you're requesting and all the fields. And that's worked really well because it manages both the sort of hierarchy. It sort of cuts off the hierarchy at the right point and also supports caching because you don't have clients requesting all their own things and ending up busting the cache all the time.
Interesting. I'm guessing you put a lot of effort into that. There's nothing off the shelf or a gem that's just going to do something like that for you.
Yeah, I did. I've created a framework, which I probably should blog about a bit more, but it's basically where with Rails, you've got models, controllers, workers. So I created a new hierarchy called faces, similar to the traditional sort of value objects, you know, that represents how you push an object through the network, but sort of like that on steroids because it actually has all these options and with a language like Ruby, which is very dynamic, you can do a lot of reflection with that as well. So you can actually do a lot of that automatically, what I was just describing there. I just sort of have to sort of wrap, you know, I take this face object, I wrap the actual data model for it, and then I say, you know, I sort of declare these attributes get passed straight through in this, you know, in this face object, whereas the other attributes are custom. They can be customized. And then I also declare what are the children and what are the parents of this object, and all of that just gets pulled in automatically.
So if any of our listeners want to play along at home, I just browsed on Player FM, and then I looked up Herding Code, which is player.fm/series/214, and I just put a dot JSON at the end of it. And then I really like, you know, I'm looking through this, and like you said, you've got this kind of the hypermedia approach to it. So then like it has the lookup, latest lookup, latest verbose lookup. And so then that has that episode detail equals full.
Yes.
And so that's all kind of spelled out in there.
Yeah, that's part of, I think, one of the good principles of an API is to be self-documenting. So that's really to help. Actually, that's something that was a little bit of a mistake in the sense I didn't want that latest verbose lookup to be actually used because it sort of ties people to something that might change or might expand over time. So it's a good example where that should ideally be a comment. But the principle is the same. It's really showing people how to make use of the API through the documentation inside the response.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, though, because some people will say with hypermedia that you should have a smart client that's going to follow. You know what I mean? If it does change over time, that the client should adapt to it.
Yeah, that's the sort of HateOS dream of having
right.
This. I think that's evolving, but it can sometimes be a bit of a fantasy, and I haven't been wanting to go through that path yet. I think it's certainly something that requires a lot of thought and a lot of maturing of the API before you can really guarantee that's going to really work effectively.
Right. That was going to be my next question, is if they are actually doing that. So it's self-documenting, but you know, somebody building a client's going to shouldn't depend on that.
Yeah, at this stage, yeah. And you'll get different formats. So you're looking at a series there, but one of the features of Player FM is that it also has these kind of mixed channels. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Herding Code, you're in this featured programming channel, which will be player.fm/featured/programming. And if you go there, then it's the same principle, but it's not an individual podcast feed. It's a curation, so it's a mix of channels, a mix of feeds. And the same principle applies. So you can then get .rss, .json. And the RSS and the OPML formats are interesting because you can actually import them into any podcast client as well.
Wow.
Yep. Is Player FM doing some of the curation, or is this community-based, or how's that work?
Yeah, the long-term view is for it to be community-based, but to get it going and give it some traction, we've basically done it ourselves. So I've hired a content expert who will go around and just look up, you know, what are quality feeds, quality shows, like yourself, of course, and really make sure that they're following certain standards, that they're frequently updated and so on, and then putting them into the right categories. And over time, it can be community curated. We've already done some trials with users who are creating their own, because we just have this user. The reason it's called slash featured, it looks to a user like a fancy purpose-built URL, but really we've got a user called featured. And so every user gets their namespace, and any other user can create their own channels as well.
I can only imagine that you must have a lot of processing going on to keep all these feeds around and know what's been updated and when a new item arrives. How difficult was that to implement?
It was actually, in principle, not too bad to get going. With this product, I very much devolved it. I didn't want to sort of just, spend years creating it before I released it. So the very first version was just using an off-the-shelf Ruby library called Feedzilla. And, you know, I didn't even set up background processing or anything like that. I just set it up on a loop, you know. It was just this daemon loop that would run about once every couple of hours, looping through every single feed and fetching and making sure that there's a timeout. And over time, it's got more sophisticated. It's now using Sidekick, which is a popular Ruby, but very popular within the Rails community, messaging queuing system, so that I can run this every few hours, make sure that it's getting all the feeds up to date. But what I do to make sure that the feeds are up to date almost immediately is I also make use of the PubSub Hubbub standard through a third-party service called Superfeeder. So they actually push notifications into my server using webhooks, and I'll pick them up and then add them to the queue, and then they're processed almost immediately after the publisher has hit the publish button, if all things are working, if they've actually integrated with PubSub Hubbub.
Interesting.
Yeah, it works really well. And what I'm not yet doing in the clients is actually pushing to the clients, because the clients right now are still polling. But, you know, one of the plans in the medium term is to actually do proper push messaging using Google Cloud messaging, Google Cloud messaging on the Android side, and of course iCloud messaging for Apple. And basically then we can actually pretty much push it all the way through from the publisher to the client, most of the time just within seconds. So it's quite exciting. It sort of turns podcasting into a much more, real time medium, as well as everything else that we like about it.
That will be really cool.
Yeah.
Are most of your clients, are they native applications? First of all, you target Android and iOS right now.
iOS still is in development, but Android very much. And within Android, now the way Android's going, there's a lot of different surfaces within it.
that to me, I've owned an Android phone for years and I've tried to get into some Android development. It always seems like the most difficult platform.
Yeah, it's kind of mixed. I think that's got better over time. I should say I'm not the Android side developer, but my experience with it, it has been that because of the way Play Services is now being rolled out, you've got a lot less of the fragmentation issues that people had to deal with in the past. So with something like Android Wear, and we were lucky to get early access to Android Wear and show it off recently at I.O., we could actually get that out, you know, on day one, and straight away, all of these older phones, because Google pushed an update of the Wear services, you know, they wouldn't have to wait until the next version of Android to get them running. So they had access to the app and all the other apps, you know, from day one, pretty much.
So what was that integration then? You had Google Wear support? Is that like for, it would show like now playing kind of stuff?
Yeah. So there's sort of different levels of integration. I think the way Google's starting to evolve their platform along these lines is pretty interesting because they're trying to make it very easy for developers to get into. So it's not like you have to commit to this whole other new operating system. So in the case of what you were talking about just there, which is like, you know, the ability to pause and go to the next track and so on, that actually comes for free. Any app that's already using the media framework, which would be what they would already need to do things like lock screen controls and Bluetooth, it's pretty much any Android audio app. You know, they're going to have support for these built-in media framework controls. So they basically already have that on the watch from day one. What we did is we extended that to actually build an app that runs on the watch. And it's actually pretty much exactly like what you do to make a normal Android app, except it doesn't have access to the internet. So it's relying on orbiting around the main phone app and syncing back and forth with it. And what it does is it actually lets you just sort of open your watch for 5 seconds. You go through the menu or you say open Player FM and then you can just pick an episode. It's really simple. It's just sort of like a mini episode browser to kick off episodes. Because a big part of the challenge with wearable design is designing a different kind of experience. It's more like a 5 second quick interaction rather than something that would even be the kind of interaction you'd have with your phone, let alone your desktop.
Yeah, I found it also interesting on the Player FM blog that you mentioned how much demand there was for the Chromecast.
There was, watching this
on TV.
Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting to me because it's not something that I've felt the demand for, but I think a lot of people are seeing their TV as a general personal media center, you know, for the home. It's interesting because you think if people are living with lots of people in the home, you think, how is that possible? I don't know exactly. Maybe it's people who don't live with a lot of people or are alone a lot or have more than one TV, have TVs in their room or whatever, but they're sort of seeing it as just this all-purpose home entertainment system. And I think the way platforms like Chromecast are going, they're trying to promote that idea by having fancy animations and screen just trying to, like, if you look at the Chromecast, it has these very nice images that sort of rotate as you walk around and you see, like, the content that's going on, or you can see, like, the time of day, the weather. They're increasingly trying to make this TV into some sort of ambient interface that's always there with you rather than just a traditional TV that you have to sit down and watch a show for 1 hour and then leave it alone. So I think that was a big part of the demand. And there was also the video aspect, of course, even though podcasting is primarily an audio medium, there's still a reasonable amount of video, and there's certainly some popular video podcasts out there.
Do you know how much work that was to get that working?
Very little, surprisingly. To get it up and running, it was actually just a few days of work. And the reason for that is Google's done a very good job of providing the interface that runs on the TV, what you call the receiver app. So trying to keep things as lean as possible, we decided to use their default receiver app rather than writing our own HTML5 app that would run on TV. And for that, we get this great benefit of course, the getting it up and running, but of course, we get all their updates as they come out in the future as well. So really, we just had to develop on the client side, you know, kind of a standard, something a little bit like what the kind of programming I've done on the web with WebSockets is, you know, you just have topics and you sort of push to the media, you deal with events about what's happening, and very straightforward sort of API. I think the hardest part with Chromecast is actually the look and feel guidelines are quite strict, and for the right reasons, I think, because Google wants to make a very consistent experience because they've got this whole new type of product they don't want to get a bad name by users not knowing how do I turn this thing off my TV, or it wasn't pausing when I expected to. So all of that is really the sort of the polish you have to put on it to make a really good Chromecast app. Probably takes longer than the actual app itself, you know, doing the getting it up and running and functional.
You know, as you're talking about like video and additional kind of things, as you know, this makes me wonder, are there more things that podcasts can do to, you know, that you can like light up with if they provide them?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. One thing I'm really interested in is a standard, or really a suite of standards called Podlove. And that's come out of the Berlin podcasting community. What they're trying to do is a lot of the things that I think people dreamed about when podcasting first started 10 years ago, to do with things like chapters, you know, being able to declare chapters of your show, things like links, so that you can actually expose, say, you know, at a certain time, there's this link and it could appear in the client at that time. Could be great for advertisers, could be great for talking about resources like we've talked about already on this show. Things like attributions, sharing links like related feeds. Like right now, there's no real standard for how I can say, you know, I've got an audio podcast, but I've also got a video podcast. So I think there's a whole ton of things that we could do. Some of that's been done in the AAC format, but that's relying on having it in that format and also having it in the actual file format rather than an open standard that would something like Podlove, where it's really just in the feed as standard open, easily parsed tags.
Ah, oh, that's great. So yeah, I've been doing this for a while. When I type up the show notes, I include timestamps in that. So that seems like something where that would be relatively easy for me to support.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, certainly. Podlove's got a standard. They've also got an HTML5 player to go along with that. And there's also a separate standard called Time Jump that came from the Shop Talk guys, if you know them. And they've basically built this also kind of a JavaScript player support. So yeah, I think there is some movement on that front, and I think it's really important for podcasters, because a lot of the challenge with podcasters, of course, is getting the word out with so many shows. And I think one of the things they can do to help with that is highlight specific segments rather than letting them be buried inside a 1 hour show. And I think, you know, the ability to deep link into a particular segment could be quite powerful from that point of view, from just making things more shareable.
Along those lines, what have you found to be frustrating in this arena, this area?
I think one of the things has been with the feed parsing, because I do all the feed parsing myself, and it's kind of like user-generated content. You've already got the two standards of RSS and Atom, and then you've got, you know, above that, you've got all sorts of ways of declaring tags and images, and every podcaster's got different ideas on how to actually present that. There's a lot of different networks and a lot of different hosts, so it's really trying to pull all that together and just dealing on a case-by-case basis to make sure that these things are getting up to date, and, you know, dealing with things like, you know, tracking, like analytics means that you'll sometimes get different feeds and different episodes URLs changing for what is really the same show. So it's a lot of things like that, I think, are probably the most challenging part of how the whole architecture is set up.
So I've always just used FeedBurner. I figure that standardized things relatively well and includes, iTunes support and all that. Assuming Google doesn't randomly shut FeedBurner down just to crush my dreams. Any other? Is that relatively stable for you?
Yes, very much so. It's got the nice feature of what I mentioned before about the ability to push. So FeedBurner, because it actually came out of really Google and pretty much the same group of people that created the PubSubHubub standard, it has that capability built in, so that you know, you can really get your podcasts out fast to all the different clients that support that. It works pretty well. Of course, there has been a lot of concern after Google Reader shut down that it would also be shut down. We don't really know what the case is. It hasn't really had a lot of attention paid to it. So that's really the downside, I think, because it'd be nice to have a lot more, you know, even just things like the actual FeedBurner feed URL. You know, I don't think that's changed for about 6 years, you know, the style sheet that's used and so on. But yeah, it's certainly a robust platform. And I know that there are other services too now, like PodTrack, that a lot of people are using as well for their analytics.
Mm-hmm.
And is this your full-time gig?
Yeah, it is. So it's something that I started about 2 years ago, really, because I'd finished working at Google at the time, did consulting and enough to be able to bootstrap this for the long term. But I haven't yet turned on any kind of monetization. And the reason for that is it's actually really quite a complex problem, the whole idea of building a full-featured podcast app. I think that, of course, we can say that about anything in software, but I think looking at how a lot of the other clients and apps evolve, it is just a slow process, I think, because of there's a lot of features that podcast apps have built up over time that have to be implemented. And like I mentioned, a lot of different types of challenges with dealing with all the feeds. So where it's at now is it's been on the web for about 2 years. It's been as an Android app for about 1 year. And what I'm doing is I'm building it as a freemium service. So I'm actually offering it for free. I've always had this limit. So it's not like a case where I'm going to sort of switch it overnight. I've always had a limit on the number of subscriptions with the plan that we would have a gold plan, which we're starting to trial now, which would actually remove that limit and would also do what I call syncing on steroids. So it's really like taking the syncing to the next level where you do syncing your full playback history, full playback position on any episode, and in real time being able to see, you know, what you're listening to on the other players so you can sort of switch through from one device to another.
That sounds great. That sounds really useful.
I hope so. We'll find out. But there's certainly been a lot of demand for those sorts of features. I think once you do something like this in the cloud, you know, it starts to open up possibilities for future features that people might not normally think about with a normal podcast app.
Well, I have to ask. I have a Windows phone now. It seems like your web interface is actually pretty reasonable. Do you have any plans on, you know, someday doing a Windows phone client?
I'd love to. No immediate plans, just being too small, really, to be honest, to be able to do something like that. But certainly what I've done to date for other platforms that aren't supported is, as you say, like the website is very much mobile optimized. You can log in and you can get your feeds and so on. And then you've also got that possibility of getting your RSS as well, you know. So if you've got a channel on Player FM, you can get the RSS and put that into another client on a platform like Windows.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would love to support it, but it is something like Windows. It's sort of the same as Android and iOS in the sense. It's the same in the sense it's totally different. You know,
yeah.
It's a completely different platform. You can't really share a lot. So that's really the challenge with it.
And so you got to take this application to Google I.O. this year, and it sounded like, well, you were in something called the Developer Sandbox with some pretty big names, ESPN and The Guardian. What was that experience like?
That was a lot of fun. It was pretty surreal being alongside people like that because, you know, Player FM is really very small. It's really just been myself for a long time and then now outsourcing the actual clients. Yeah, it was fantastic. I think the reason I was there was just because Google wants to show people what people can do with the platform, what developers can do with the platform. And because we launched this as an Android-first product, I very much embraced products like Chromecast, like you mentioned, Google Plus sign in and getting the advantage there of being able to sign in across the web and Android and Android Wear, as we mentioned, that was really what we were showing people for the first time at I.O. So it was very exciting and it was great to meet not just developers, but users. And I think that's always a really exciting part is, you know, seeing people who are using your app and getting their feedback and seeing what they'd like to see next with it.
Did you get to attend I.O. also as an attendee, like see stuff, watch stuff?
It was my fourth I.O. I've been involved as a speaker in the past as well as an attendee, and it's just a mind-blowing experience to see the talks because, you know, a huge amount of preparation goes into them. But unfortunately, I did not. I had to stay really on the stand the whole time and do the right thing. So, I've got a lot of videos to catch up on, put it like that.
Yeah, so I find it fascinating that you have a degree in psychology, and I was curious how that has helped you out doing software development.
It's helped me out quite a bit, actually. I think there's two aspects to psychology that make it very close to software, which is the, firstly, user experience, of course. And since I did the degree in the mid-90s, you know, user experience, of course, is now much more highly valued than it was back then, thankfully. People really understand that it's important to optimize things for beginners, think about things like aesthetics and how it really makes you feel as well as just the pure functionality and performance and so on, and also optimizing for power users. So there's that aspect, and there's also the sort of machine learning and artificial intelligence aspects of psychology as well that make it very closely tied to software, I think. And I think that's really important from the point of view of algorithms. So again, it does come back to the user experience because when you're designing systems that are supposed to be intuitive and increasingly software is anticipating the user's next actions, not just making their current actions easy to perform. And a lot of it really comes down to, you know, really sort of an algorithmic way of thinking. So I think that aspect of psychology is really important as well.
I'm looking at your website here. And, so, you know, it links over like to thesis papers and stuff. It says here design reuse and human computer interaction and software engineering.
That's it. That was the topic. And, really it was looking at the very sort of early days of design patterns in software at the time. How could you apply that to human computer interaction? Because you could see that there will be a lot of potential, especially when it comes to developers who don't have traditional user experience training. You know, how can you actually transfer knowledge and how can you share it within a community so that it's firstly going to help with user experience, but also going to be using things like patterns to make things consistent within a platform. So you get sort of consistent look and feel, consistent patterns. And it's been fascinating to see the evolution of patterns in that space to a point now where I think we've got a lot of mobile pattern sites that are almost purely visual. You know, they're really just not even writing like traditional patterns do the problem and the forces and everything. They're just saying, you know, here's the pattern for signing up a user. Here's the pattern for doing search. And they'll just link to a bunch of screenshots. And ultimately, that's the real essence of a pattern.
Yeah. I forget where it is. I saw one time I was asking around about, you know, kind of, I didn't know the words to ask for, but I was basically asking for user interface design patterns. And somebody linked me to a site that had a pretty good catalog of that. And I was kind of like, of course, this is so obvious, you know, and I've never thought to apply design patterns in that way.
Yeah, definitely. It's, you know, the real meaning of the word pattern is exactly that, being able to see the pattern across all of these really good examples. There is still, I think, benefits to the traditional model of design patterns that came out of architecture and town planning, which is very formally trying to understand in a given situation, what's the problem you're solving and what are the things that you value? And the things that you value in any architecture are going to decide how you actually go next. You know, you've got different options and you have to make the trade-offs depending on what you value most. Do you value getting this up and running quickly? Do you value the safety? Do you value security? Making those decisions and those trade-offs is a big part of how traditional software design patterns should work.
Speaking of UX, one thing I really like about the Player FM website is that it doesn't have the usual cheeseburger show up where everything collapses into something you have to click on to get anywhere.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, a cheeseburger, it's got its advantages, but I think it can be a little bit confusing for users too. You know, I'm not sure what people have done with user testing to see if it really is something that people are aware of. I just think, intuitively, I'm not sure if that's the case, that people actually know that they can actually go and hover or click on it. What we're doing for we're also building a desktop form factor website, you know, that's basically like a Chrome package app. And for there, again, you know, I just want to create like a side menu similar to what's on the phone side menu, actually, that's showing you your current shows, your settings and history and all that sort of thing. Again, you know, the idea there was to make it always present so the user can just go there without thinking.
Are there any performance optimizations or scalability challenges that you face with the API?
There are, because I think especially with the mobile world, you have to be really careful to keep the bandwidth low and reduce calls, because it's not just about the bandwidth, but it's about turning the mobile radio on and off. You want to minimize the number of calls that you're actually making. So one of the main optimizations I've done on the API, which is kind of unusual, I think, and really something I think a lot of developers could get some benefit from, it's using the idea of similar to what we do on HTML and CSS, which is using these kind of cache-busting version IDs or timestamps for subsequent resources past the initial resource. So in the case of a traditional HTML document, typical pattern is the client will make a call, like it could just be a browser, make a call for an HTML document. That will always get a fresh result from the server with the latest content. But what it will also do is it will link to CSS and JavaScript that has got version details like a timestamp or a hash of the content to make sure that it's unique. So every time the content, the CSS or the JavaScript changes, then that will get updated, but otherwise it's cached forever. So you can actually keep it on a CDN close to the user, and you can prevent making that call at all if it hasn't changed since the last time the browser requested it. So we've done something similar in PlayerFM with the API, where basically we will use a timestamp on information inside the first response. So the user request, we request for a user every hour, say, to see the latest data relating to the user. That will come back with a list of channels, and those channels are timestamped. So the browser, or sorry, the mobile app knows immediately, should I actually go off and fetch this channel again? Has it changed since the last time? Most of the time it hasn't, so it doesn't have to make that call at all. If it has, say it's like the baseball channel, and it finds out that, you know, 37 minutes ago, the baseball channel was up to date, so it was updated. So then what it will do is it will make a call back to the server for this updated baseball channel. But we've got all these, you know, CDNs in place. PlayerFM's fronted by Cloudflare. And that means that very close to the user, you know, typically it will be in the user's own country, that will already be cached, because there's probably another user who's requested the same channel maybe 5 minutes ago or 10 minutes ago. So that protects the server from getting hit again. And it means that the client gets the details a lot faster. So I think it's a pattern I'd like to see people use more in their APIs, is actually to be able to timestamp these subsequent child results that come in a hierarchical response.
You know, one thing I was wondering with that, I don't know if you've looked at JSON-LD, JSON for linking data, because then you could put e-tags on all the sub-responses.
Yeah, that would be a pretty similar principle. It's something that I've contemplated, and it's almost like the same thing, because we use timestamps, and it's kind of like the last modified standard. It's pretty much the same thing, but I actually considered using e-tags in that subsequent request, but actually the way I've just outlined it doesn't actually have a lot of value, because you know, pretty much if you're making the call, you're doing it because it hasn't been updated. So it's kind of like the same thing, but I think it sounds like, I haven't used that standard is pretty much going along the same lines, which is quite cool, because it's really going to be a big performance improvement.
Yeah. And then, and especially since you are basically the main, you know, real consumer, like you're optimizing both the client and the server. You know what I mean? So you can optimize around that, around your, whatever your.
Yeah, that's right. Because it is imposing a little bit more burden on the client. So if you had a platform where you really wanted people to be buying into it and you wanted to make it easy as possible, then again, talk about the trade-off. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really about, you know, maybe trading off some performance. Losing some performance, but for the benefit of just being easier to write the client. But in our case, we really have the ability to do it on both ends, so we try to optimize on performance.
And have you found Cloudflare to work pretty well for you? We use it on Herding Code, and it's been extremely helpful.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, I don't use it to serve media. I guess you're using it to serve media, which is interesting, because there was an article about this, about, you know, what is the actual limit, because in principle, you could just turn it into this infinite media server, which is actually not what happens. At some point, they'll give you a call and say, you might want to consider upgrading, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like for an API and a website, it's been fantastic. It's just a matter of making sure you really understand, and it's got some interesting things that caught me by surprise at first. So it does things like caching 404 error responses, and temporary redirects will be cached for a period. So you have to be really aware that it's not just, you know, caching resources that you explicitly mark as being cached, that it by default it does a lot of other things, and you can then turn those things off on a case-by-case basis if you want to.
Yeah, I was wondering how easy it is to get something out of the Cloudflare cache if there was a problem.
You can actually purge the whole cache, or you can purge a single file. It would be really nice if you could purge on some sort of wildcard. But what you can do is you can actually build up rules on a wildcard. The funny thing is, when you actually add a rule, another thing that can trip you up a little bit is it doesn't actually purge the cache from that point. So if you add a rule to bypass the cache on some wildcard, you have to then go in and make sure that the existing items in the cache are cleared.
You know, when I first set it up, and this is just, you know, website hosting kind of, you know, stupid little guy messing with WordPress, but I am, I would make a mistake like posting an update from hotel Wi-Fi and it would have a wrong link to something. And then I had, you know, I had caching on WordPress. I had caching on Cloudflare. I had Feedburner is also, you know, another level of caching because they don't ping up immediately. And so there's a lot of, you know, all these different caching layers. It's like, where exactly is the problem?
That's you know? True. Yeah. It would be nice to see more information in the headers actually, because that's something that can be really quite hard to diagnose.
Mm-hmm.
I've got similar issues with, I do a staged rollout on the server. So I also got tripped up there when I was setting it up because I would be serving a resource from the Canary server. That's like the initial test server that's not really on the public internet yet. And of course, you know, that would go back, you know, it would have some sort of property like in the CSS and it would be starting to request fonts or images from the servers, which are load balanced, and they would be starting to serve from any server. And that would get cached as well. So when it actually came into production, you'd have these old resources getting cached that are no longer applied because you'd have the old CSS hanging around. And things like that can be quite hard to actually figure out what exactly is happening without actually looking at the server and the code and so on. You can't just look at the packets alone and figure it out.
Mm. Yeah, and it's like, as you're saying, you know, that's something where headers could definitely help.
Yeah, definitely. That's kind of what they're for, isn't it?
Wow. Do you do any kind of special tag markup stuff so that it appears differently in search results? I had one time where I was searching, I forget which, there was a site that had like showed a player, like it basically showed better markup that showed, yes, it was media and all that kind of stuff in the Google search results.
We do actually. We were one of the early people to be allowed into the Google App Indexing setup. So we can actually, because Player FM, like we talked about before, it's very much trying to make URLs for podcasts universal so that you can treat podcasts the same and sort of stabilize how all the different podcasts are presented and what sort of different players they are. That was kind of part of the principle of starting this. So everything has a URL. And for that reason, it works on the web as well as working in the Android client. So if a user, this is really the principle of deep linking is, you know, that increasingly web pages are just becoming this big mash of tags of, you know, metadata. And a lot of the time, they're really just pointing into apps these days. So with Player FM, if you actually point to any URL and the user has that installed on the phone, it will open up in the app on the right place. So that's the deep linking principle. And then Google's built on that further so that search results under the right conditions will actually show a prompt. Of course, one of those conditions has to be the user has the app installed. It will show a prompt in the search results. You can open this inside the app.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it is nice. Yeah. I mean, I think it's very much the way things are going on all platforms is the URLs and the whole web is becoming much more of a sort of API platform architecture than just something that people are actually looking at inside their browser.
I'll be looking forward to the discovery features. I've always been frustrated by those and over the years with the existing application.
Yeah, it's really exciting to me. You know, there's so much more that can be done. Like I mentioned with recommendations, I think social sharing will be really powerful. So the ability to be able to share things that you're liking, to be able to see what your friends are subscribed to, because we already have that idea of you can make your channel public or private. So you can actually, if you want, because it's something people used to ask me all the time, you know, before I started this, they knew that I was a mad podcast nut and they sort of asked me, you know, what should I be listening to? So now I've just got a page. You know, I can point them to player.fm/Michael and you can see the shows I'm subscribed to and the topics I'm following. And, you know, wanting to make that much more of a fine-grained experience so that every user can build their own set of channels and their own shows within that. I think, it's a big, some big opportunities there in the future. One thing we do too actually is full text search. So that was another thing that I always wanted to be able to do is actually to be able to search on individual show notes and, you know, search for, say a TV show, a particular episode, you can do that with the full text search as well.
Wow.
That would be a fantastic feature. I agree.
Yeah. Well, that's there. That's there on the website and on Android. So it's backed by Elasticsearch. So the way that works is basically pretty standard, I guess, architecture of just keeping the two things in sync between the database and Elasticsearch. And it's been fantastic. You know, it really performs well and it's a very easy platform to get into. And what it's trying to do is make podcasts so that you don't have to subscribe and wait for it to download and so on. It's also about just sort of discovering ad hoc shows and sort of adding it to your play later list and then listening to them one off, even if you haven't yet subscribed to that series.
Is there a way to incorporate transcripts for podcasts into that whole searching system?
If the podcast, if it's in the show notes, yes. If not, it would be kind of an interesting standard, I think, maybe that Podlove might have considered, but it would certainly be cool if you could have some way of you know, like a standard markup for the transcripts over here.
Mm-hmm. I've looked into that some, you know, with like Web VTT and stuff. There's support for that for video, but it doesn't seem like people are looking at it for audio.
That's interesting. Is that the sort of track tag to do with so you can actually see?
Yeah.
Yeah, and sort of follow it, right? So you can do like time coding and you can see what someone's saying at a certain time. I think that would be really fantastic for audio as well. I don't know that it actually eliminates audio. I think most of the use cases, well, it's, you know, probably partly driven by Google and YouTube, I guess. So mm-hmm. Video is a big part of that. But yeah, certainly that would be fantastic because what I was saying before about virality, you know, it's really important for podcasters to be able to share individual segments within that. And a big part of that is sharing a text snippet so that it can be posted on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. So within that, I think that, you know, it'd be really nice if you could be able to publish, say, a couple of paragraphs of transcript and at the same time link to the audio.
Yep.
So what do you do when you're not working on Player FM?
It doesn't leave a lot of time, yeah, I spend a lot of time when I'm not working. I like to get out and just do sort of like a gym or exercising. I just find, you know, I really need that break. That's also why I love the idea of audio and podcasts is just, you know, while I'm in the gym or while I'm working out in the park or whatever, you know, I've got the audio with me. And, you know, to the extent that I can, try to travel around because I'm in a foreign country, even though I've been there for a while, but it's nice to see a lot of things around Europe and in particular in the UK. There's so many historic sites that are, you know, within a few miles of you that I do try to get out to them when I can.
And how long have you been in San Francisco? Is that semi-permanent there?
That's just really, I've just been here for Google I.O., sort of make the pilgrimage here about once a year, one way or another, and I.O. and just sort of following up on meetings and seeing a few people here and there.
Gotcha. So what's coming up for you? Anything new and exciting in the immediate future?
In the immediate future, focusing a lot more on discovery. So we've done a good job on getting all of these kind of niche topics covered, but we need to start to make it more intelligent now that we've got the kind of cloud intelligent. We can do things like collaborative filtering and saying people who listen to this also listen to this. Doing play tracking, again, that's been something in keeping it lean and building the system up over time. We're not yet doing any kind of server-side play tracking, which means we can't actually track on an individual basis recommendations and so on based on what you're actually listening to at any time, and we can't give podcasters analytics, so we want to change all that. And beyond that, just sort of building out to more platforms, like I mentioned, iPhone in development and also a kind of desktop form factor that will work offline, which will be a Chrome app. And possibly we've got done a little bit of an open source project actually that's kind of like a phone gap for the desktop that basically will take a Chrome app and compile it into a desktop native app that will run on Apple and Windows and Linux.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was kind of a fun experiment, which it's building on Node WebKit that really does a lot of the heavy lifting. But rather than building a dedicated HTML5 app using that platform, we decided it would be nicer to start from a packaged Chrome app so you can actually build it for Chrome first and then push it out to the platforms later on as a native app.
So we're almost out of time. Any last words? Anything to look forward to?
I'd just like to really thank you guys for having me on. It's been a lot of fun. And if people want to get in touch, they can mail mike@player.fm. I'm happy to answer any questions about the topics we talked about in terms of the architecture or the API or anything like that.
Very good. I think this has been a great show. So thanks for being on, Mike.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And also thanks for showing Herding Code at Google I.O. So that concludes another episode of Herding Code. Thanks for listening.